The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, or CJSR.
Bring it on! The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, 'cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. Today we're speaking with Dr. Kimberly Côté, director of the Brock University Sleep Laboratory in St. Catharines, Ontario. From the avalanche of emails we received as soon as we announced this topic, it's obvious that far too many of us desperately need a nap. Before we get to our feature presentation, I want to take a few minutes to talk about an event happening at DragonCon. For those unacquainted, DragonCon is a science fiction fantasy convention in Atlanta, Georgia. It happens annually over the Labor Day weekend, and it is ridiculously fun, as anything that has people wearing costumes of their favorite comic book characters and several Star Trek captains is wont to be. But to add to that, Derek and Swoopy from the Skepticality podcast started a skeptical track there. So you can hear panels on everything from how to be a skeptical consumer, to teaching children to think critically, to paranormal investigation workshops. Now, Derek and Swoopy will be on the show in a few weeks to tell us more about SkepTrack, but we wanted to give you an early heads up about something that may very well sell out by then, the DragonCon Star Party. And here to tell us about that is the organizer, Maria Walters, of SkepChick.org. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, Maria.
Thank you.
So the Star Party is a fundraiser, correct?
Yeah, it's a charity event and we're raising funds. This year we're doing it for the Light the Night Foundation, which is the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. And last year we did it for the American Cancer Society. This is our second year doing it, and we're doing it in memory of Jeff Medcalf, who was the blue-collar scientist. He was an astronomer and a friend to a lot of us, and unfortunately he passed away a few years ago from liver cancer.
So why is this party awesome?
Why isn't it awesome? You get to hang out with a bunch of very cool people, look at the stars. This year, we've got the Emory University Math and Science Center, which has a huge observatory on top of it. They're going to let us look through their telescopes. They're also going to have smaller scopes set up on the roof to do stargazing. And there's also going to be food and drinks, and the whole thing is going to be, we're going to have entertainment from the hosts of Astronomy Cast, so Pamela Gay and Fraser Kane, and music from George Rapp. And I really can't think of a better evening. It's really going to be a lot of fun.
And how much are the tickets?
Tickets are, you have two options, depending on if you would like alcohol or not. Soft drinks only are $50. That's entertainment, food, and soft drinks. And then if you want alcohol, you get additional beer and wine tickets for $65.
Now, how many people showed up last year?
Last year, we actually we sold out and we capped it at 100 people. This year, we'll be probably right about the same. The space is a little bit bigger, so we may raise the cap just a little, but it'll be right about that. It's a 100 people, but it's still a fairly intimate event. Everybody gets to talk. It's a lot of fun.
So people should hurry then. So where can
people should definitely hurry. We will sell out, I'm sure. You can get all of the information at atlantaskeptics.com/starparty, and everything's there. You can buy tickets right off of that page.
Perfect. Thanks, Maria.
Thanks very much.
And now to our regularly scheduled Speaking Up. We're here with Josh Hunt, assistant organizer with the Cleveland Skeptics. Hello, Josh.
Hello.
So you're here to talk about a new project.
Yes.
Do tell.
It's called Critical Thinking 101, and its main purpose is to offer a sort of a crash course in critical thinking to someone who is new to skepticism. And also it can serve as a refresher course for seasoned skeptics and seasoned critical thinkers.
So what kinds of resources are included on the page?
I've divided it up into four categories, and the four categories are video, audio, articles, and books.
That's an interesting idea, because I do speak to a lot of people that don't listen to podcasts at all, or don't read blogs.
Yes. And I figured, since we live in an age of YouTube and Google Video and all this multimedia, so many people you know, they have very short attention spans, and you know, so they digest video better than they digest audio or reading an article.
So what kinds of topics are we talking about then?
We're talking about general stuff like cognitive biases, how we can fool ourselves, such as the confirmation bias, where we seek out information that confirms what we already believe and ignore information that disproves what we already believe. So we'll seek out stuff that already proves what we believe and ignore everything else. That's in there. And also logical fallacies and how to argue. So it's, I'm really trying to focus on how people fool themselves with their perceptions and also how arguments can go wrong. So that's why I have links to logical fallacies and how to argue.
So is this really about outreach to people who have never heard of skepticism? Or is it more about giving sort of already self-identified skeptics somewhere where they can access these kinds of resources?
See, for me, when I was coming into it, I had no one telling me, you know, where to start. So I'd say it was for the person who is interested in, like, you know, what's skepticism? I want to learn how to be a skeptic. I want to learn about science and critical thinking. So it's for them, and it's also for people who want to reach out to friends and family who aren't skeptics, and it provides a wealth of material to send them. So I have videos that people can send to friends and family. Hey, check this out. This is a cool video. Like, there's a video on there of Michael Shermer giving a talk at the TED conference from 2006. And I've sent it to friends and family who I would consider non-skeptics. And they've responded very positively to it. They said, that was so cool. It was informative. It was entertaining and funny. And they're getting that that education value. So, yeah, it's for people who are already, I guess, skeptics. And the material itself could then be accessible to people who are non-skeptics as well.
So we wouldn't send them, for example, all of Critical Thinking 101. It's sort of more specific resources to specific circumstances.
Absolutely.
So are the resources pretty accessible, or are they more academic then?
They're pretty accessible, especially the videos. Brian Dunning's Here Be Dragons is very, very effective at communicating all of these things and what the red flags are and identifying pseudoscience or, you know, nonsense. As far as academic goes, I would say Skeptoid may be the most academic.
So we're talking accessible then.
Very accessible.
Wonderful. So would this actually cover the question, what is skepticism? Because I've been told by many people that they really have a hard time finding an explanation of the term, one that isn't 10 pages long or filled with jargon.
Absolutely. We have a page on our website also that's not on the Critical Thinking 101 page. It's called What is Skepticism? And there's a quote from Eugenie Scott that's just very clear and succinct, and it's a sentence long. And I also posted her talk from this recent Skeptical, which took place in California here, at Skeptics Conference here, where she talked about skepticism and science. And she's really great at explaining what science is and isn't, and skepticism is and isn't. And this is her quote. Skepticism is a perspective that does not accept or reject claims at face value, but withholds judgment until sufficient evidence is available to make a decision. And I think that really sums it up.
That's ideal. That makes sense that it's Eugenie Scott.
Yes.
Actually, even the word skepticism is a bit intimidating to some people. And I'm wondering if you had that in mind when you named this Critical Thinking 101.
Yes, you've read my mind. Or just made a very good guess. Yeah, I realized that when I would tell family and friends that I was a skeptic, I was like, oh, you're one of those. It was always that kind of reaction. So skeptic or skepticism has a very negative connotation to it, to the general public. And this was my attempt at countering that.
So why do you think that is? Why do you think that is such an intimidating word?
I think the public's understanding of it is they make it synonymous with cynic, or someone who's negative, or someone who just doesn't believe, or someone who's just contrary, just to be contrary. So I think that, especially in popular TV and movies, like there's a show called Supernatural on the WB. My sister, knowing that I'm a skeptic, she showed me this one scene from one of the episodes of Supernatural where the guy was explaining, oh, we have to make this drawing in the sand and make it in this kind of thing so that it'll ward off the witch or whatever. And then one of the guys that were with it went, oh, kind of like that, dismissive. And then the main character said, no one likes a skeptic.
Oh, my.
So that's her perception of a skeptic, and everyone else's, I think, in the general public.
Right. So do you think that maybe this is possibly that people don't see how skepticism applies to them personally?
Yes, I do. And with this resource, I want to show people that it does apply to your life, because knowing how to think for yourself and base your knowledge on evidence and sound logic, you can make very, very informed decisions from a sale on fruit at the local grocery store or where to take my car in for, you know, to have it fixed. People should understand from this that they're being provided tools to make very sound life decisions.
And this page will help with that.
Absolutely.
And where can people find it?
You just go to www.clevelandskeptics.org, and on the right-hand side, it'll say More About Skepticism, and you'll see Critical Thinking 101.
Wonderful. Thanks, Josh.
You're welcome.
And we'll be right back with more Skeptically Speaking after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. You can email your questions for next week's episode to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, we're at Skeptical Radio, or use our handy question submission box on the website at skepticallyspeaking.com. After the show, continue the conversation in the comments section of the website, or check out our Facebook group. You can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, and while you're there, why not add a review of the show? Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of wonderful radio stations. Check the media page at skepticallyspeaking.com to see if we air near you. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I'm here with Dr. Kimberly Côté, director of the Brock University Sleep Laboratory in St. Catharines, Ontario. Kimberly is also an associate professor in the psychology department, and her main research interests are in sleep, performance, and cognition. Welcome to the show, Kimberly.
Thank you.
So you've been researching and writing about sleep since you were an undergrad. So how did that become an area of interest?
That's a long story. I guess I became interested in my own sleep and dreams when I was still in high school. And I guess it's probably a little strange to know what you're interested in that early on, but I pursued that and stayed in school for a long time and studied sleep.
Well, sleep's actually quite a broad area of research, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's very multidisciplinary, actually. There are psychologists interested in sleep, but also, obviously, the medical profession, which includes neurologists, psychologists, or psychiatrists, and respirologists.
How does one research sleep exactly? You're not just standing around watching people nap, I assume.
No, I have a sleep laboratory at the university. It's a 3-bedroom sleep lab that looks a little bit like an apartment. We have a kitchen and lounge, and we have a washroom. We have 3-bedroom suites that have beds and curtains, and also we have a computer in each bedroom, because a lot of what we do is waking performance assessment to see how waking function is affected by sleep and sleep restriction.
Has the field changed at all since you've begun researching?
Since I've been in the field for 20 years or so, there's been a lot of advances in our understanding of general neuroscience in the brain, and along with that comes an understanding of sleep. Our gold standard technique to examine sleep is polysomnography, and a lot of people might be familiar with that if they have or have known someone who has gone to a sleep disorders clinic for a test. So the clinical assessment is a single overnight in a sleep laboratory where they put electrodes on your scalp and they monitor your brain waves, your eye movements, your muscle activity, and your heart rate to know what stage of sleep you're in, and also often to see if you have any respiratory or movement-related disorders during sleep. We do that in a research lab as well, but oftentimes we're doing all sorts of other things, like looking, for example, at the role of sleep in memory and learning. So we look at how sleep or how memories are consolidated in sleep.
Now, you mentioned stages of sleep. It isn't mm-hmm. really as simple as being asleep and then being awake.
There are 5 stages to sleep. At the beginning of the night, we fall asleep into a transition stage. We call them stage 1, 2, 3, 4, and then REM sleep. So stage 1 and 2 are light sleep. You spend about 60% of the night in this stage 2 light sleep. And for healthy young adults, they'll spend about 20% of the night in deep, slow-wave sleep. That's the restorative sleep. Unfortunately, this begins to dissipate even in young adults. And for older adults, this deep, slow-wave restorative sleep is almost gone. However, our REM sleep stays about the same after we reach adulthood. Babies and children have more REM sleep than adults, but once you reach adulthood, you stay stable, and about 20% of the night is in REM sleep, or what we call rapid eye movement sleep. And that's most commonly associated with dreaming. Although we dream all night, our brains are constantly thinking and active during sleep. But if I wake you up in REM sleep, that's when you're going to report one of these dreams that's much more vivid and bizarre. Whereas if I wake you in another stage of sleep, your cognitions and dreams might be more simple.
Now, we have actually a question on that topic.
Okay. This is a question from Struby. What parts of the brain are most active during vivid dreaming?
Well, vivid dreaming, again, would be the REM sleep. And while sleep is kind of a whole brain process, what's happening in REM sleep is activity from the brainstem region of your brain that is sending signals to the rest of the cortex. And it's thought that basically this sort of random stimulation of the brain is what all of these bizarre images are when you're having a dream, yet the frontal cortex part of your brain that's trying to make sense and logic out of everything tries to synthesize these random images and make a story out of them. And that's why the dream story tends to be so bizarre and leap illogically from one thing to another.
And I think it goes without saying that they are not in any way prophetic.
Yeah.
So from an evolutionary perspective, shutting down and being inactive for, you know, approximately up to a third of a day isn't really a great strategy for not being eaten by a predator. So there must be advantages to sleep.
Right. And this is, I think, one of the great mysteries of neuroscience and of science is why do we sleep? It's an extraordinary amount of time that we do spend sleeping. And we know that it's absolutely necessary, that we cannot go without sleep. But yet scientists don't really know exactly why we sleep. There have been a lot of advances in this area. And one area recently that has gotten a lot of attention is this area of memory and learning. And there's probably not a single function of sleep. There are likely multiple functions of sleep. And there seems to be a great deal of evidence that one of the functions is to consolidate newly learned material and formulate memories.
We have a question from the website.
My psychology classes made brief mention of a study that involved keeping people awake for several weeks at a time. The subjects still performed well in any given task, and there were no physiological side effects. So it seems like sleep is a behavior, but not a necessary biological function. Thoughts?
I wouldn't agree with that. There's a great deal of research that has been done. The first human sleep deprivation study was done in 1896, and there have been thousands of studies since. And there are profound deficits in your reaction time, attention, motor ability, visual acuity, and particularly mood is affected. If the length of sleep deprivation is severe, you can get things like hallucinations. And I guess what's interesting is that when you're sleep deprived, your performance doesn't just take a downward slide, like a linear decline. Your performance and your function actually waxes and wanes. So even though you may have been awake for 36 hours, there are times where you might be feeling like you're okay. And even your performance on a task at that moment might be okay relative to someone who slept, because it's waxing and waning. But what happens when you're sleep deprived or even just sleepy for a short period of time, you get lapses in attention. And these lapses will become increasingly long, and they will occur more frequently as the sleep length continues. And if you're having these lapses in attention and performance, then you're more likely to make errors, for example, on the job or while driving or just simply with whatever task it is you're doing. And depending on the task, that can be anywhere from a nuisance to a deadly consequence from falling asleep or lapsing in attention.
But that's kind of normal sleep deprivation, right? How bad can it get, really? Because what we're presented with in movies and on TV shows is it could drive you insane or eventually kill you.
Well, I think that the drive for sleep is so powerful that we don't seem to be able to truly deprive ourselves of sleep. Now, we can do this in a laboratory as an experiment, or people can have tried this themselves to sleep deprive themselves. But what always seems to happen is that people will nod off to sleep. Now, if you were trying yourself, oh, I'm just going to stay up all night and see what happens, probably around 4 or 5 in the morning, you're going to give up the battle, and you might not even do it willingly. You'll just find that you've fallen asleep against your will. It becomes such a powerful drive that you can't keep yourself awake. And even in the laboratory, when there's an experiment or they're prodding you continually to keep you awake, your brain is waning, losing consciousness constantly. It's slowing down, and it's really difficult to actually deprive someone entirely of sleep.
We're speaking to Kimberly Cote, director of the Brock University Sleep Laboratory. If you have questions, email us at live@skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet us at Skeptical Radio. So now, you've mentioned that you've done quite a bit of research on sleep and memory. And actually, we have a question from the website on that.
I once had a big test I was studying for one night. I memorized everything except one thing that I found confusing. While I slept, I dreamed all night that I was rehearsing what I had been studying, including the thing I had trouble on. The next day, I felt much more prepared and finally memorized the one thing while I slept. What effect does sleep have on solidifying what we learned the day before? Would this apply to procedural memory as well? That's from Ginger Pomico.
Yes, memories are consolidated in sleep. And what you're referring to, that experience of working on a problem while asleep, it's interesting because anecdotally, most people have had this experience, or there are writings about similar types of experiences where a problem was solved while sleeping overnight. But there actually has been some research that systematically investigated this, whether insight to a problem could be achieved through sleep. And so there is evidence, certainly, that memories are consolidated in sleep, and even more specifically, that we can problem solve during sleep. And procedural memory is something like riding a bike or solving a puzzle and things like that. And yes, those types of memories in particular seem to be served by sleep, and a particular stage of sleep. It's the stage 2 sleep that seems to help procedural memory, and particularly a brainwave that happens in stage 2 sleep called a sleep spindle. Sleep spindle is a phasic event. It's an EEG waveform that we see. It's unique only to sleep, and we see it in stage 2 sleep. And the amount of spindles that somebody generates in stage 2 sleep, whether it be an overnight sleep or just a nap, is related to the degree to which they'll improve on a procedural motor learning task on the following day.
So if it is possible to work out problems in your sleep, is there any way to make that more effective? Can we take advantage of that?
That's a million-dollar question. If somebody solves that and markets it, they'll be very rich. Certainly, I think that in the long term that science is moving that way, that we will understand more about our cognitions in sleep, and you know, the relationship between sleep and waking function and cognition, and how to tap that a little bit better to understand possibly even what dreams mean, and how to either control that content or get something out of it personally.
So I guess one of the big questions is, how much sleep do we actually need? At what point are we sleep deprived?
Well, that's a good question, and it's an individual question for everyone. It's different. On average, adults sleep somewhere between 7 and 9 hours. On average, that would include most people. However, there are those lucky short sleepers who get by on less, and there are people who really, truly do need more. It's a normal distribution. So one of the sleep myths that you often hear is that you need 8 hours of sleep. And you hear that perhaps in media or pop culture. And so for people who are not 8 hour sleepers, and they might feel like if they're not reaching that 8 hours, that there's something wrong. However, if the way that you determine your own individual sleep need is to pay attention to how you're feeling the next day. Are you rested? Are you reasonably alert, not falling asleep at inappropriate situations, able to concentrate? If 7 hours of sleep leads to you functioning on the next day, then that's your level of sleep, and you don't need more.
So does age or gender have any effect on that?
Well, age certainly does. Older adults tend to sleep less. So for young adults, on average, between 7 to 9 hours. But for older adults, it's on average probably about 6.5 hours. And interestingly, that's not because they need less sleep. It's simply that they have lost the ability to sleep well and to regulate their sleep as they get older because of a number of changes to the mechanisms that control sleep and circadian rhythms.
And we have a question from the chat room.
How does sleep deprivation affect the body at 24, 48, and 72-hour periods? And what's the longest a person can stay awake? And that's from Greg Fish.
Okay, so how does sleep deprivation progress over time from one night to two nights to three nights of sleep loss? As I was saying, it certainly will get worse. The more time awake, the worse your brain function, the worse your waking function and performance is going to be. But as I mentioned before, it's not an obvious linear drop off a cliff. Your performance will wax and wane over those 3 days because you're also interacting with not only that sleep drive that's increasing as every hour of wake increases, but it's interacting with your circadian rhythms. So even though you've been up for 2 days, there will be windows of time where you're starting to feel a little bit better because of your natural circadian rhythms, which also control your arousal level. So your performance will wax and wane, but generally, with that amount of time, it's definitely getting worse over time. And I believe part of the question was, what's the longest anyone's ever gone? And that's a difficult question to answer. Nobody's ever died from sleep deprivation. But it's like I said, I think that this very powerful drive kicks in and prevents ourselves from really, truly sleep depriving ourselves 100% and from going that far. So there's been some accounts of people who've stayed awake for outrageous amounts of time, but you have to question whether or not they were really awake.
We actually have another question from the chat room, and everybody loves the sleep deprivation questions, obviously.
Is there any evidence that repeated sleep deprivation induced hallucinations, such as those caused by stimulant abuse or manic episodes, can cause long-term psychological damage? And that's from Morrison's L.
Is there any evidence that the consequences of sleep deprivation, if they're extreme, could cause an actual psychological break? I suppose that could happen, certainly, but it's not a real clear causal thing. There is a lot of evidence to show that sleep in general is related to psychiatric illness. There's data to suggest that for people who develop an episode of depression, for example, that in the 2 week period prior to the episode beginning, there's a lot of evidence that there was insomnia or a loss of sleep. So there are a lot of different links showing that when sleep is fragile, you're certainly at risk for new onset of psychiatric illness. So I wouldn't say that it's a causal thing that
right.
Losing sleep will drive you crazy, but with all other factors and predisposing factors, it definitely could be a precursor.
With all of this talk of sleep deprivation, can we sort of catch up on some of that through napping, let's say?
Well, napping can be a good thing generally. If you're a healthy, good sleeper and you have the opportunity to nap during the day in your workplace, that's great. It'll improve your performance. It'll improve the bottom line for your employers.
And I want their job.
Yeah, and it's a very progressive thing if you're allowed to nap in the workplace. But there are certainly people that do that and cultures that take that more seriously. So napping can be good, but the question was in the context of sleep deprivation, I guess.
Is it actually good for us?
Yes, napping is good. If you're a poor sleeper, however, if you have insomnia, then you want to avoid napping because that will steal away from your sleep and you've got to be really strict about your sleep-wake schedules. But if you're an otherwise healthy, good sleeper, then napping is a good thing. But in terms of catching up on lost sleep, that's a bit of a myth. Let's say, for example, you're only getting 5 hours of sleep during the week, staying up too late, getting up too early, and just simply not allowing yourself enough hours in bed to sleep. Then basically you can't wait till Saturday to catch up on that sleep because the risk you've put yourself at for increased automobile or work-related accidents and your cognitive decline in performance, that's happening the next day on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. So it doesn't really make any sense to wait till Saturday to catch up on sleep because you've already put yourself at risk.
I am one of those people who keep attempting to nap with very poor results. And I was told that there actually may be a nap sweet spot that I may just not have found yet. Is that possible?
I think there are certainly individual differences in napping ability that go beyond napping preference and opportunity to nap. So for some people, they don't nap because they just don't have the time or the place during the week, and that's one thing. For others, they can't nap even if given the opportunity, or if they do take a nap, they feel quite groggy afterwards. So there are certainly individual differences in the benefits that we seem to glean from a nap. And certainly a proportion of the population realizes that about themselves and they self-select out of napping. They're non-nappers.
Now, one of my sound people, Grant, has a question.
Okay. So why does napping too long make you groggy?
Well, an ideal nap time would be from 10 to 20 minutes, and this is why. When you first fall asleep, you go into that light sleep. But if you're going longer than 20 minutes, and especially on up to an hour, you're going to be really getting into that nice, comfortable, deep, slow-wave sleep. And when you awake from slow-wave sleep, or if you've obtained any slow-wave sleep in your nap, it's going to cause you to be more sleepy and lead to greater sleep inertia, we call this, or sleep drunkenness. That's, you know, how long does it take you to kind of shake off that grogginess after you wake up, either from a nap or first thing in the morning. And that sleep inertia will last longer if you've gone into the deep, slow wave sleep, and it'll lead you to feel like your nap was not as restorative. So that's one good reason to have just 10 to 20 minutes. Another reason is in the workplace, on the job, it's much more practical amount of time, and research has shown improvements in brain function and performance following just 10 to 20 minutes a nap with a minimal amount of sleep inertia.
But again, that's only on people who actually do well napping.
Yeah, those are most of that research is done in habitual nappers. And research that I did in my laboratory on habitual and non-habitual nappers, we found that it was only the habitual nappers that actually showed that improvement in procedural motor learning following a nap. They generated the nice spindles and improved their performance following the nap. But the non-nappers that we forced to take a nap, they did actually get the same amount of sleep, but their performance did not improve and their brain physiology did not change. They did not generate more spindles.
That was a very disappointing study for me to read, by the way. I've actually also heard quite a bit about polyphasic sleep. So can you explain that? Because that's similar to napping.
Okay. Now, by polyphasic sleep, do you mean just willfully changing your sleep pattern so that you sleep more like a cat on and off whenever you can rather than an 8-hour consolidated bout?
That's the one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Shift workers, some shift workers find success with doing a split sleep where they'll sleep a bit before their shift and a bit after. in two separate shorter bouts of sleep, and that seems to work well for some people. I don't know if for most people, if they could change to a polyphasic kind of pattern and get any benefit from that. I don't think that sleeping whenever it will do the same kind of benefit as sleeping when we're supposed to. Again, it's that interaction between circadian rhythms and our sleep pressure that dictates when we sleep and when we wake up. So you'd really have to be altering a strong biological tendency to sleep at night to do that.
So would you see any advantage from that? Because I skimmed the internets, and there's quite a few different programs that you sort of put yourself on, and there's 4 to 6 to 8 different napping times a day that you forcibly put yourself into.
To go into a polyphasic pattern.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the evidence is that works or how many people would be doing this. Like I said, I'm familiar with the fact that shift workers have some success in altering their sleep pattern, but not really in a polyphasic way, more in a biphasic way, sleeping in two different bouts. But I've not really heard of anyone successfully moving to a polyphasic pattern and getting any benefit from that. Just socially, I would think that you're going to be asleep at more times than other people are awake, so I don't know why that would be really of interest.
And actually, that was the primary reason why people stopped the polyphasic sleep plan,
because
I think they lost all their friends. We have another question from the website.
Is the so-called polyphasic sleep schedule possible to maintain long-term? That's from Mobile Diesel.
I don't have any direct knowledge of that myself. I'm not sure about that area.
Now, I'm just wondering, because that would almost be sleep deprivation at a certain point.
If you didn't do it successfully, I guess. Now, the problem with that is, you know, if I simply said to you, you're going to have to flip your sleep schedule and start sleeping during the day tomorrow, you're not going to sleep as well. So that's the concern. If you're going to try to adjust to this polyphasic pattern, which again, I'm not sure why, but if you were to do so, you're going against your natural rhythms, biological rhythms. So I would suspect that you wouldn't be able to sleep as well, and you would probably be depriving yourself of sleep and increasing a sleep debt over time.
If you have questions for Kimberly Cote, director of the Brock University Sleep Laboratory, email us at live@skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet us at Skeptical Radio. And we'll be right back with more after these important messages.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're joined by sociologist and author Barry Glasner. For 10 years, his book, The Culture of Fear, has shed light on the way that cultural anxiety is manufactured to drive media ratings and win votes for politicians. The book has recently been updated to cover the trends of the last decade, and Glasner will explain why we're still afraid of all the wrong things. And on Everything You Know Is Sort of Wrong with Greg Layton, do poor people have more babies? That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, Friday night at 6 p.m. Mountain Time at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. We'd like to take a moment to congratulate Dr. Phil Plait on the announcement of his new TV show. The bad astronomy blogger and author of Death from the Skies will be hosting Bad Universe on the Discovery Channel. He'll look at civilization-ending disasters in the movies and on TV, tell us if that could really happen, and we'll probably blow things up. Hopefully it will do for mass extinction what Mythbusters did for urban legends. Congratulations, Phil. And I'm on the line with Dr. Kimberly Cote, director of the Brock University Sleep Laboratory in St. Catharines. So over the week, since we posted the episode, people on Twitter and Facebook have been continually mentioning that they want to hear about insomnia. So first of all, is insomnia a sleep disorder?
Yes, definitely. Insomnia can either be secondary or primary. And what's meant by secondary is that you have trouble sleeping secondary to some other medical or psychiatric illness. But there is also what we call primary insomnia, which means that the complaints of poor sleep cannot be explained by some other medical or psychiatric reason, and the insomnia is primary. It is the disorder itself.
So what causes that?
Well, the typical life of insomnia is usually that it begins, a couple nights of poor sleep begin with some precipitating event. This might be the stock market crash, something dramatic like that, or death of a family member. It could just be a bad time, like the end of semester, where there's a whole lot of stressors going on in your life, and you start to experience some a couple of poor nights of sleep. Now, that stressor or precipitating event, combined with your individual predisposition to be a poor sleeper or not, combined with poor habits that you begin to develop, creates this this life of insomnia.
We have a question from the website.
In your capacity as director of a sleep laboratory, how much insomnia do you find can be mostly attributed to sleep hygiene as opposed to somatic causes? And that's from Zen Monkey.
And if you could just explain sleep hygiene first.
Okay, sleep hygiene are behaviors to engage in that will lead to a good night's sleep. A lot of it's really common sense. Don't drink coffee late at night. Don't engage in activity that will raise your heart rate too much. You know, so, you know, the half hour before bed, you should spend time doing more soothing things like relaxing, taking a bath, probably not balancing your checkbook, nothing that will stress you out or start you ruminating about anything that's going to stress you out. So sleep hygiene is just good habits. Poor sleep hygiene is linked with insomnia. Patients with insomnia will always have very bad sleep habits. Part of what's happened to them is they've really gotten off of having a good, solid sleep structure or schedule. And part of the behavioral therapies are to get them back on a good schedule and get them back engaging in good sleep hygiene. But that said, sleep hygiene alone isn't, you know, really the main cause of why people have poor sleep. It's much more complicated, as I was talking about before, that cycle of a stressor combined with poor habits leading to maladaptive sleep habits and like a learned insomnia. So you learn to become a poor sleeper. And what happens for an individual with insomnia who's having poor sleep night after night chronically for weeks to months, they start to associate everything in their bedroom environment and everything about the act of going to sleep. They start to associate all that with poor sleep. So the brain becomes trained or learns that all of this is associated with a bad night's sleep. So when the insomniac lays down to go to sleep, they just become wired. They're wide awake and they start to ruminate and usually have a lot of anxiety about sleep itself, not about other things, but about whether or not they'll get enough sleep and whether that, if they do lose sleep, that will affect the next day.
So, of course, everybody wants to know what they can do about it, besides just normal good sleep hygiene.
Yeah, and insomnia is a tough behavior to tackle, and the best approach in my mind is cognitive behavioral therapy, which would be supervised by a clinical psychologist who's trained in sleep medicine. And in Canada, I think that's quite hard to find, unfortunately, but that is, to me, your best strategy for long-term treatment of insomnia. Of course, there's evidence that sleeping pills work. They work in the short term especially, but the research shows that to really tackle the causes of the insomnia and make sure it's gone in the long term down the road, that cognitive behavioral therapies are a better strategy.
So any truth to the drink a glass of warm milk remedy?
I don't think it has to be warm. The warm might be soothing and relaxing, as I indicated, is a good thing. But milk has tryptophan in it, which will basically release serotonin, which will help you sleep. But you'd have to drink quite a bit of milk, really. So it might have some benefit. But basically, for people with pretty strong sleep disruptions, that type of thing is not going to help.
And how about the idea of exercising before bed? Because we hear both, that that'll keep you up, but it'll also make you tired enough to sleep.
Yes, because I think that both of those things are true, that exercise in general is good for your health and will help you achieve regular solid sleep on an ongoing basis. But if you exercise too close to bedtime, you're going to raise your heart rate and your body temperature to a level that's not conducive to falling asleep. So common sense, don't, you know, go for a run and then crash into bed.
Actually, when you and I were talking before the show, you mentioned that there were specific things that travelers could do for jet lag-related insomnia.
Yeah, well, it's not really to treat the insomnia, but more of a strategy to prevent the ill effects of traveling across time zones. So jet lag occurs when you're traveling east or west and for two or more time zones. And whether you're traveling east or west, you can help to adjust ahead of time by either shifting your sleep by an hour or two leading up to, slowly shifting, so over a week, in the direction that you're traveling, either delaying your sleep or advancing your sleep. You can also do that with light or with melatonin to help advance or delay your circadian sleep pattern systematically leading up to the time that you're going to travel. And also, when you do travel, the best advice is what pilots always tell people is start living by the new time schedule as soon as you're there. So even though you're exhausted from a long day of travel, and you arrive to Europe and it's only 10 a.m., you should stay up. But of course, you should do that and be safe. Don't drive.
We have a question from the chat room.
What's the shortest amount of sleep per night that the average person can sustain for a week straight? And that's from Mystic 99.
Again, that's going to come down to your individual sleep need. There's no minimum. Like, I can't say, hey, as long as you got 5 hours, you could function. That's not true at all. In fact, if you're an 8-hour sleeper and you're getting five, you're going to be profoundly affected. And we know that the deficits day after day are somewhat cumulative over time in the research that's looked at a week or two of sleep restriction. So there's really no minimum amount. Every person has to find out for themselves what is the amount of sleep that they need to feel rested and function on the following day. And then they need to try to achieve that amount of sleep by allowing themselves enough time in bed every night, 7 days a week.
And again, I'm on the line with Dr. Kimberly Cote, director of the Brock University Sleep Laboratory in St. Catharines. Email us at live@skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet us at Skeptical Radio. And as you may have noticed, we've received some interesting questions this week, but the following are some incredibly interesting questions. Apparently, sleep brings out the best in people.
I read an article that mentioned that scientists had not been able to explain a study that showed a bright light shone on the back of human knees can reset the brain's sleep-wake clock. What are your thoughts? That's from Jeremy.
Well, there are two studies that I know of that were done. So there was the original study that got a lot of attention that showed light on the back of the knees reset the circadian clock. And, of course, that got a lot of attention because even the scientists couldn't figure out, well, why would that be? What mechanism is there located behind the knee? And they thought that it had something to do with the circulatory system and the fact that there's something in the circulatory system that reacts to the light properties that then communicates with your brain to shift your circadian rhythms. And that was the premise of the first paper. However, another group of researchers repeated the study using almost identical methods, but they took some more cautious controls. So they made sure that when the light was being exposed behind the knee, that they blindfolded people. So because in the initial experiment, they would have gotten some peripheral or secondary light through the retina, which is how we understand that light will interact with the suprachiasmatic nucleus in the brain and phase delay or advance your circadian rhythms. So basically, there has been more recent research that has essentially debunked that original study and come up with some pretty clear explanations for why they think that the original study showed what it did and why they led to those conclusions.
And we have another question from the website.
Can you please explain to people what narcolepsy actually is? I have it, and when I tell people about it, they look at me as if I could keel over at any moment.
Yeah, narcolepsy is an interesting sleep disorder. It affects about 1 in 2,000 people. It's characterized by profound excessive daytime sleepiness, but also sleep attacks. Those are the main symptoms, is sleepiness and sleep attacks. So the person can fall asleep in an instant, almost like a switch has been turned off. There are other associated symptoms that not everyone with narcolepsy experiences, one being cataplexy, which is when there's a sudden uncontrollable loss of muscle. So the person will collapse to the ground. And that those cataplexy attacks are often triggered by emotion. So telling somebody who has narcolepsy a joke might cause them to collapse like that. So it can really profoundly affect the person's quality of life and enjoyment of life. There are other symptoms such as sleep paralysis and hypnagogic hallucinations that tend to go with that constellation of symptoms in someone who has narcolepsy. There's been a lot of advances in the research in this area into understanding what's happening with narcolepsy, and it's thought to be due to a loss of hypocretin cells in the brain, and we're not sure why they're lost yet. It seems to be a progressive loss of these hypocretin cells in the hypothalamus that control this level of alertness and these sleep attacks during the day.
And another question from the website.
What does the latest research say about sleep paralysis?
Sleep paralysis can be a benign parasomnia. Parasomnias are just bizarre things that happen in sleep. They don't necessarily have any reason to be alarmed or a particular medical problem associated with them. And sleep paralysis is one of those. So probably everybody has experienced this at least once, and they think, wow, that was a really neat thing. It's when you wake up, it's almost like it's a disorder of arousal. So it's like consciously you're waking up, your eyes are open, you're looking around the room, yet your body's still paralyzed. That paralysis that is normal in REM sleep, but not so normal when you're awake. And it can be a little bit scary when you come up out of REM sleep really quickly and your body's paralyzed and you're thinking, why am I not moving? And it's kind of a scary but also kind of a neat experience in sleep. Now, again, it can be benign, but for some people, like individuals with narcolepsy, they can experience that more frequently and also have the hallucinations associated with it, and it can be more frightening. And again, an indicator that an individual may have narcolepsy.
Is there a distinction between sleep research and dream research?
Yes, I guess they're related, but also distinct. Dream research has come a long way since the 1950s when they did discover REM sleep or rapid eye movement sleep as a distinct type of sleep within sleep that involved more vivid dreaming. So once researchers knew that, they were able to more systematically start to explore dreaming. And but again, as we discussed right at the beginning of the show, it's such a multidisciplinary field. So dreams is one question within the field of sleep that covers almost everything you could imagine.
And a question from the website.
Here's my question. What keeps you up at night? How does sleep affect your life, given that it's part of your area of study? And that's from Austin.
How does sleep research keep me up at night? When I was a student, I was the one who had to stay up at night watching others sleep. There's something kind of ironic about that. Now that I run my own sleep research lab, my students and my assistants do most of the overnight, so I get to rest now.
So if you could actually tell people one thing that they should know about sleep that they don't actually know, what would it be?
One thing that they should know about sleep. Well, I guess from a health perspective and a cognition and performance perspective, just that sleep is important for your health and well-being and your waking function. It's as important as diet and exercise. And I think that a lot of people don't look at it that way. They think that they can get to sleep later or in a busy working schedule or social schedule, that sleep is the first thing they can cut down on and they can get back to that later. And I think what people really don't understand is how much sleep impacts your waking function, your performance, your safety, your well-being, and your health. Even we didn't talk much about that tonight, but there's a great deal of research now showing how sleep loss leads to obesity, diabetes, heart disease, and all sorts of other things. So I think that if most people understood how important it was for your health and well-being and waking function, that they would make it more of a priority, make time for sleep, and make sure that they scheduled enough hours, time in bed every night to make sure that they could get that sleep.
So are there any kind of resources that you can direct people to if they want more information about sleep?
Yes, there's two good resources I can think of. One is the Canadian Sleep Society website. If you go to the Canadian Sleep Society website, there are brochures on there in both French and English that have been prepared by experts in the field, and they cover a range of topics. I've written one on normal sleep. There's also one on all kinds of sleep disorders like sleep apnea, insomnia. There's one on sleep in women, sleep in children, what to expect going into a sleep clinic for an overnight study. So there's lots of great pamphlets. The website for that is css.to. That's Canadian Sleep Society.to for Toronto. Perfect. And the other good resource available out there is the National Sleep Foundation in the U.S., and they're just an excellent organization to provide the public with information about sleep. And their website is sleepfoundation.org, nationalsleepfoundation.org.
Kimberly, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you.
Do head to the website for all of the links to Kimberly and the Brock University Sleep Laboratory. And you can also visit our website at skepticallyspeaking.com, where you can find links to our Facebook group, to Twitter, and to iTunes, where you can very conveniently subscribe to the show. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Hi, this is Joey Haben from the blog Newly Nerfed. As someone who is disabled by chronic illness, I and others like me are the favorite targets of all kinds of medical scams. Remaining a critical thinker in the face of this is vitally important. Sure, some snake oil is harmless, but that's not the point. What isn't harmless is wasting money and possibly risking your health just because someone who seems credible suggested it to you. It's not always easy to think rationally when you're tired, sick, and vulnerable, but that is exactly when it's most important. I never stop asking the questions, how do I know this is true? Where's the evidence? And if those questions don't lead me to some solid, reliable data, then I know that miracle cure isn't much of a miracle at all. Whether the information comes from a well-meaning family member who heard about this great new treatment, or a quack whose only motivation is to divorce patients from their pocketbooks, investigating these claims with a skeptical mindset may not just save your bank account, it may also save your life.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell, gonna raise a little hell, break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking, online reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus pocus, out of focus, locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor, leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter, your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're skeptically speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is recorded at CJSR in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada.
Our on-air producer is Michael Harrison. Our sound technician is Ryan Bromsgrove. Post-production editing by K.O. Myers. And I'm your host, Desiree Schell.